Well, I'm Charlie Liebert. I live in North Carolina. I know I don't talk like that because I come from originally from New York, but I could talk like that if you'd like, but I don't think you'd understand much of what I have to say. So I'll revert to my Yankee accent. I'll just start with a little humorous story. In Sunday school in second grade, the teacher was teaching about God's omnipresence, that God is everywhere and God sees everything. And one of the little students, little Johnny, was having a real problem with that. And she could tell he was having a problem because he kept kind of fidgeting around and stuff. And she finally said, Johnny, she said, do you have a question? And he said, yeah. He said, you're talking about God being everywhere, but where is God when the sun shines? And boy, she was kind of flabbergasted by that kind of, what do you mean, Johnny? Where's God when the sun shines? He says, we always sing Our God Reigns. Okay. We're going to deal this morning with Noah's flood and Bible history in the first hour. In the second hour, we're going back to Genesis 1 and take a look at what Genesis 1 has to say. Okay, so we're going to start with Noah's flood. Noah's flood and other Bible history. And to do that, I'm going to begin my presentation with a little bit of discussion about catastrophic events. Because, in fact, Noah's flood was a catastrophic event that changed the surface of planet Earth. It actually changed more than the surface. It changed the whole environment in planet Earth. But it changed planet Earth radically. And I want to start with another event, a modern one, to kind of put us in perspective, because it's hard for us to grasp just how dramatic this was unless we go back and look at something else that maybe give us an illustration. And I'm going to start with the eruption of Mount St. Helens, May 18th, 1980. Well, let me start with a question. Where was the Garden of Eden located? Australia. You can tell Ken Ham made these slides, right? America, in the area around the Tigris and Euphrates, and we can't know. Let's try it. Australia, everybody raise your hands. I didn't think there'd be any takers. America? No, we're not. Around the region of the Tigris and Euphrates. We can't know. Anybody go for that one? I saw a couple hands. Okay, that's actually the right answer. Because the planet was completely reconstructed by the flood, the Tigris and Euphrates are rivers named from the rivers that existed before the flood, but they're not necessarily in the same place. So the Garden of Eden, we really can't know where it was. It may have been there, but it may not have been there. There's really no way for us to tell, because that represents hundreds and thousands of feet of sedimentary rock that's been overlaid on top of what was there before the flood. And we'll talk about the flood process a little bit later, okay? Let's go back to Mount St. Helens. May 18th, 1980, Mount St. Helens erupted. And when it erupted, for the first 48 hours, the energy release was the equivalent of, listen to me carefully, one Hiroshima-sized atomic bomb per minute. This is a small, small catastrophic event on planet Earth. Huge amounts of energy being released. And at Mount St. Helens, in the eruption, this is the picture before. If you look carefully at the picture, you'll notice the red dotted line. That's the mountain that will disappear in about 2 minutes. That'll be blown into pieces and deposited at the base or deposited up into the atmosphere. There's the after picture. 1,300 feet of mountain were blown away in a catastrophic explosion. And that catastrophic explosion laid down between 200 and 300 feet of sediment material laid down at the base of the mountain over several eruptive processes, a lot of it the first day, but also some later on, mostly to the north side of the mountain. If you look here carefully, you see pyroclastic flows right above where the mountain is, where the cone is. That's where the material is laid down. And that material gave us a picture for the first time of sediment that was laid down very rapidly. Now, focus particularly on the central part here. Notice all the individual layers. They look a lot like layers you would find if you went to a place like Grand Canyon and looked at what the canyon looked like. And if you go to a geology class in a university, they will tell you the way you tell how old something is you count the layers. And every layer represents a seasonal cycle, either 6 months or 1 year. So we could count the layers in this section, we'd have probably hundreds, perhaps maybe 1,000 years. Yet it took less than 8 minutes to lay that down. God gave us a gift at Mount St. Helens, and the gift was this. We saw for the first time how sediment could be laid down and look like it was old and be young. And that's not the only thing he gave us here, because you notice this is exposed. It's exposed because Immediately after the eruption here, about 2 years after, there was a series of catastrophic, what's called pyroclastic flows. Flows that moved through the mountain and tore out sections. In less than 2 days, a canyon the 1/40th the size of Grand Canyon was torn out, and a river would be there, not forming the canyon, but being an artifact. So God gave us another picture. Erosion can happen quickly, very rapidly. And we'll come back to that a little bit later. Look at these layers carefully. I mean, if you took geology textbook, there's hundreds of years right there. And there isn't. We know that. That's minutes. Minutes of reaction. It turns out that this stuff is deposited quickly, and it still has the striated layers that would represent slow deposition. Okay, let's go back to the beginning and talk about the pre-flood world. Most creationists, and I say most because creationists are good scientists, and good scientists never agree on everything. That's part of the nature of science, okay? The nature of science is such that, first of all, science has limitations. Science can tell us about the past, but it cannot tell us about the past with any certainty. It can only tell us about the present and the future. It can only tell us about the material world. Science cannot address things like, do I have a soul? Or can I live eternally? But most creationists believe that on day number 2, when God created the earth, and we'll come to the more details in the second session on this, he put more water above the earth's atmosphere. And the water would have compressed the atmosphere to about 1.5 to 2 times the present day pressure. Your body's probably designed for that because you know if athletes use a breathe right, you know the breathe right thing you put on your nose? I use one at night because I snore really bad. And my wife says it really helps to change the tone of the snoring. It doesn't appear to help change the snoring, it just helps change the tone of the snoring. But in that design of having the atmosphere above, compressing the atmosphere, 2 things will happen to living organisms. They will grow larger and they will live longer. We know they grow larger because we've got that in the fossil record. Because the fossil record is a deposition on Noah's flood. We'll talk in some depth about that in a couple minutes. We know that because the fossils are big, right? We've got big dinosaurs. Well, dinosaurs are reptiles, and reptiles grow as long as you feed them, so there's no reason to expect why they wouldn't be big. But we have other big things. Ladies, you're going to love this, okay? Imagine in your kitchen a 12-inch cockroach. Yes, fossils of 12-inch cockroaches. Or a 51-inch wingspan dragonfly. Those are real fossils. The pre-flood world was different, and things got bigger. But things also lived a lot longer, because under those conditions, they're called hyperbaric, things would live to about 10 times normal lifespan. We know the 7-day bacteria, we grow it in those conditions, lives about 70 days. So the person whose lifespan would be 75 years would live 750 years. So now we have an explanation of how the people could live so long in the pre-flood world and why, after the flood, those lifespans dropped almost immediately to a very low level. So we've got the water in the upper atmosphere. That creates also a greenhouse effect on the earth, which means simply that the earth is like a garden from pole to pole. No polar ice caps. The weather report is real simple. It's going to be about 55 degrees tonight. It's going to be about 75 degrees tomorrow when the sun shines. When the sun begins to rise in the morning, about 1 inch of water is going to condense on the ground to water the ground. There's never going to be a cloud, never going to be a storm, not going to be hardly any wind. Real easy weather report. Pre-flood world, no wind, no rain, no weather as we would know it. Now, in addition, we know from the Bible what the Bible tells us, and we'll see this later on, that there's large amounts of subterranean water, water that's under the ground, underneath, which the Bible will call the fountains of the great deep. We believe there's no salty seas or oceans. We believe that simply because we think salt is an artifact of the flood, that the salt was subterranean, and when the flood happened, the oceans became salty, or the water bodies became salty. There's indications of that because the saltiness in the ocean is still increasing quite significantly as time goes on. The whole earth is like a garden, and all the animals are vegetarians. They eat fruits, vegetables, and nuts, nothing else. So the earth would look like this on day number 2. Vapor canopy above, compressing the atmosphere. A global ocean on day number 2. We'll get to the days in the second session this morning. A global ocean on day number 2. And you've got the greenhouse effect. That is the effect of the sun being reflected back against the upper atmosphere, creating that effect from pole to pole, making the whole earth like a garden, giving us an incredible garden. Of course, we know the plants grow bigger too because we've got fossil plants that are large. Imagine ferns that are 6 to 8 feet tall. or 60-foot tall cattails. Big stuff. Here's just an illustration of some of them, right? We have some human skeletons that are about 10 feet tall. Yes, Adam was probably 10 to 12 feet tall. Adam was not 6 feet tall, probably about double the normal size. I mean, think about it. How are you going to get that 12-inch cockroach if you're not bigger, right? You'd like to be at least a little bit bigger, right? So just look at the list here, okay? 18-foot hornless rhino, 51-inch dragonfly, 12-inch cockroach, 60-foot cocktails, 8-foot beaver, 6-foot centipede, 2-foot grasshopper. Everything was large in the pre-flood world. Okay? And those are real fossils. That's not something creationists have made up. Okay? Evolutionists recognize that. I can read evolutionary textbooks. They'll talk about the wonder of this in a certain... They put it in a time period. We don't. But they put it in a certain time period. So that's a pre-flood biosphere. Creation-wise, I love these cartoons. Dan Letha does a great job. Look at the beautiful rainbow. It's a promise from God. He'll never again flood the entire earth as he did in Noah's day. My Christian college professor says that Noah's flood didn't cover the entire earth. He said it was a localized flood. That's what he said. Well, so he believes God promised to never again send a localized flood, and there they sit in a localized flood. I mean, imagine a localized flood like one described in the Bible. I mean, the Bible's pretty clear that the flood covered the mountains to 15 feet above. So let's take a look at a localized flood. Before we do that, let's go to the description of why it's not localized. Why did Noah have to build an ark? He could have walked to the other side of the mountain, right? Well, he had to build an ark because it was a worldwide flood. Why did God send the animals to the ark so they would escape death? He could have sent the animals somewhere else, other ones. Why was the ark big enough to hold all kinds of vertebrates if they never existed? If they only Mesopotamian animals were on board, the ark could have been much smaller. And why would you put birds on anyway? They could just fly away. And then how could the waters rise 15 feet above the mountains? If water seeks its own level, it would have gone down. And people who didn't happen to be living in the facility wouldn't have been affected by it. Therefore, people would have escaped God's judgment. And God says he's going to flood the whole earth because of mankind's wickedness. And God would have repeatedly broken his promise never to send a flood again. Here's a local flood. If we had a local flood. No, the flood was worldwide. The Bible's pretty clear on that issue. So God told Noah to build an ark, right? He's very specific here, okay? He tells Noah exactly how to build it. Yet, when you get your Sunday school materials and stuff and look at it, they have all kinds of different pictures of the ark, right? But God gives Noah specific instructions. He said to Noah, and let's read this, "The end of all flesh has come upon me." God gives his reason for the flood first. "The earth is filled with violence, and I'm going to destroy them." Then he tells Noah what to do. "Build me an ark." Tells him what materials to use. Use gopher wood. Make rooms in it, pitch it on the inside and outside, that's waterproof. Make it a certain size, 437 feet by 73 feet by 45 feet. Finish it above, put a door in it, put three levels in it, and then God reiterates again his divine judgment. He's going to do this because the wickedness of mankind is so great. So what did the ark look like? Well, Noah had the plans, and he could have imagined all kinds of arcs, right? You see these in your Sunday school materials. Please, when you use Sunday school materials, find some that show an ark that looks like the ark. It's a barge-like boat that's large and narrow, has a window on the top, is 400 and about a football field and a half long, about a football field and a half wide in terms of width, and about 45 feet tall. Higher than a three-story building would have to be, but I expect the levels inside some were larger than others because of the height of the animals. I mean, you think about it, you need a high ceiling for a giraffe and an elephant, but no, don't need a high ceiling for mice, rats, chipmunks, and squirrels, right? So you probably had different levels inside of different heights. And the reason it's shaped the way it is because a boat shaped like the ark you saw in the pictures would tip over in seas. They've actually used models of the ark in water baths to see how the ark would survive. And it turns out that based upon the proportions, the ark would survive waves even up to 150 feet tall. Now, how many of you have been in the ocean and seen waves like 20 feet or 30 feet? I was in the ocean one time, and I was in off New Jersey on the coast in a 35-foot boat, and the seas were 20 feet tall. And I'll tell you, I don't want to do that again, okay? That was not any fun at all, because it's kind of shocking when you see sky and you see sea. and you see sky, and you see sea. Just go up and down and see one or the other. But the ark would have been able to survive huge weather conditions. Let's look at the internal capacity. 1.4 million cubic feet, 1,360 tons. The internal capacity of the ark is about 522 railroad boxcars, which would be enough to take the animal the size of a sheep. And we use a sheep as a good example because a sheep is kind of a typical size, right? Cows are bigger, but squirrels are smaller. So we take a sheep, we use a sheep-sized animal, about 125,000 animals. Is that enough to bring all the animals on the ark? And that's a good question. The answer is yes, it is, because you bring the animals on by kind. And in the second session this morning, we'll deal a little bit with dogs and talk about how broad a kind can be. But if you look at kinds here, and just take a look at different kinds. If we look at the different kinds of creatures, this is how many animals we'd need. For mammals, about 7,400, 7,430 animals, different kinds. Now that's two dogs. And those dogs include all the wild dogs, all the domestic dogs, coyotes, dingoes, and wolves, because they can all cross-reproduce. So for that great variety of creatures, we just need two animals. So we've got 7,428 mammals, 4,600 birds, about 3,700 reptiles. And notice, no insects. I mean, think about it. Is termites a good idea on a wooden boat? I don't think so, okay? Well, of course not, because insects don't breathe the way other animals do. And the Bible's very clear on this. It says, Noah, take the air-breathing, land-walking animals onto the ark. So insects don't breathe. In fact, a lot of insects can survive underwater or even have part of their life cycle underwater. You can take an ant and put it underwater to live about 2 days. It won't really drown. Now take a cow and put it underwater. How long does it live? A couple minutes, right? Yet the evolutionists want us to believe that a cow started to swim and became a whale. That's another story, though, isn't it? So we got 1,500, almost 1,600 animals. You need two. You need the male and female. So you need two of those. So you got two of those kinds of creatures. So, and the capacity we said is 125,000. So there's more than enough. You could double that for all the extinct creatures. We got to put some dinosaurs on here too. Probably about 50 different kinds of dinosaurs. 50 different kinds. Hundreds of species, but kinds is just about 50. And dinosaurs don't have to take on full size either, right? Because dinosaurs are reptiles. They hatch from eggs. So the hugest dinosaurs, even the giant 40-foot-long, 25-foot-tall T-Rex, is going to hatch out of an egg about that big. It'll be about that big in the beginning. It'll be mature enough to reproduce at about 4 to 5 feet tall. So Noah could go find two T-Rexes, 4 to 5 feet tall, take them on the ark. Not a problem. Not a problem at all. That's how our cynics disagree with that. We'll come back to that one in a moment. Reasonable men realize some fossil creatures like dinosaurs could find no room on the ark. And he's thinking mature, big dinosaurs. But remember what I said before. Reptiles grow as long as you feed them. That's why parents, pet snakes are a bad idea. I mean, I've got a friend that captured a North Carolina black, it's called a black rat snake. And they usually grow to 3 or 4 feet long. And they're good snakes because they kill the rodents and stuff that we have around our area. So they're considered good snakes. But he captured one, and the snake was injured, so he kind of kept it because he's a reptile guy anyway. And he's got a whole bunch of pet reptiles. He actually does some reptile ministry, and he just kept this creature. Now, he kept it in captivity, so it's nice and safe. It's not eaten by some predators and not killed by anything, so it just grew. And because the reptile just grew, and it grew. And this Carolina black rat snake is now 6.5 feet long. And it will continue to grow as long as it lives because it's a reptile. So he's thinking about that when he says this here, but he's forgotten the fact that this is not what the ark looked like, okay? Noah didn't try to get creatures on like this, okay? He took creatures that were small enough to go on the ark. Because we know dinosaurs hatched from eggs. That's an egg clutch. That's actually a model of a set of fossils that was found in China. And there's kind of a drawing and a sketch of what some dinosaurs might have looked like hatching, okay? Kind of cute, actually. I've got in my collection at home a little model of a baby T-Rex about that big that you can kind of put on your shoulder and take a look at it. It's kind of cute. I think they were gentle giants. I don't think they were aggressive creatures. Okay, so Noah gathered the animals together and brought them on the ark. When he brought them on the ark, he brought them on two by two, put them in their constraining areas, different kinds, all kinds. You see, and the artist has been true here. He showed some different kinds of dinosaurs also. And then finally, Noah says to the animals, now listen, we're going to do this alphabetically. What do zebras say? Oh, the poor zebras. They're going to be the last guys on board. He was hoping he'd do it by reverse alphabetically. Now, second aspect we want to focus on here is this. Flood legends. In almost all the cultures in the world, they have legends of a worldwide flood. And those flood legends have some common elements. The legends generally describe the flood as being worldwide. The flood as being such that mankind and the animals were saved in some kind of vessel or boat. And finally, that the flood was caused by man's wickedness. Now, those threads run through almost all the flood legends across a whole bunch of cultures. And I'll give you one example in just a moment here. In fact, here's one good one. In China, the word for ark is a composite, since China is a pictographic language. It uses symbols rather than alphabetical letters to describe things. It has a series of symbols to assemble the ark. And the symbols that combine for the ark are a vessel or boat, the number 8, and the symbol for mouth or person. So the Chinese symbol for ark is 8 people in a boat. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Sounds just like what the Bible has to say. Here's some pictures of some of the other legends. This is the Babylonian legend. Notice they've added their cultural biases to it. This is the Japanese legend. This is the Hawaiian legend. Now they have a lady here doing the hula. And ladies and gentlemen, that's culturally wrong. Because that would be considered an offense. Because females did not do the Hawaiian hula dance. The dance was done by men. And it was done for purpose, okay? The dance is actually a recounting of the history of the people. See, the Hawaiian people originally have no written language. As a result, they wanted to communicate their history. And when King Kamehameha united the islands, he decided he wanted to have a way that the people could understand the whole history of their people from the time he came till the modern time, by a series of symbols, and the symbols he chose to use were part of a dance. So young men in a tribal group, at the age of 12 or 13, would be taken to the island of Kauai, up into the region called Napali, the cliffs. If you saw the movie Jurassic Park, you saw them as the helicopter flew in, okay? And if you ever go to Hawaii and go to Kauai, make sure you take that helicopter ride, okay? I've done it, it's quite spectacular. But the point simply is this, the young men were taken there, and they were trained. They were trained for 3 years. They were trained exactly how to do this dance. And then they had their final exam. Boys and girls, you'll love this. They had their final exam. And the final exam, they gave the dance. If they did it correctly, they would go back to their tribe and ultimately become a chief. If they did it incorrectly, off the cliff to their death. Yes, that's true. The beaches on the north slope of the island of Kauai are prohibited from anyone but even native Hawaiians going there, except by special permit, because the beaches are lined with the bones of the young men that were cast off the cliff. It's considered sacred ground today. But even they remember, in their legend of that dance, the flood of Noah, the worldwide flood, because of God's judgment, people and animals saved in a boat, as described in the Hawaiian dance. Just a little aside for you. And finally, the Toltec Indians in South America have it right, okay? They've got an ark that looks pretty much like the ark would have, except it doesn't have a window on top. Okay. Undocumented first use of the well-known phrase, we really missed the boat. And then, the flood of Noah will never happen. Noah's been warning us for judgment from God for decades now. One message you never want to receive from God is, I told you so. Think about Noah for a second. Noah was a righteous man, the only one. He and the 8 members of his family were the only ones left on earth. No one else. The Bible tells us, in addition to constructing the ark, Noah preached for 120 years. Pastor, think about this. You preach for 120 years and not one person gets converted. You're going to get discouraged. Well, Noah didn't. Why? Because he believed God. Because he knew God was faithful and God had told him what he was going to do. He said, Noah, because you're the only one left, I'm going to judge the earth, and I'm going to bring a flood on the earth. I've got a little role play I do when I work with youth called Ahmed, and Ahmed is Noah's neighbor. And he talks about crazy Noah building the ark next door. And the monologue ends with Ahmed going like this, looking up and saying, where's that water coming from? Because the water will begin to come as the flood process begins. We'll get to the flood process in just a moment here. Okay, the Genesis flood itself, besides being documented in Scripture, is documented in a number of other places. Throughout the Old Testament, just some biblical references here, throughout the New Testament, and all kinds of other historical sources. So the flood is remembered not just by the documentation in Genesis, by the documentation of real of all of history. All kinds of people have documentation that talk about Noah's flood. And this is the documentation we have in the Bible. It came to pass after 7 days, the waters of the flood were upon the earth. The 600th year of Noah's life, the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day all the fountains of the great deep were broken up. The windows of heaven were opened and the rain was upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, ultimately the flood period will be 371 days. 1 year plus 6 days. I don't know why God did it that way, but it's 1 year and 6 days. The time from Noah goes into the ark till the time that Noah steps his foot back outside the ark. Okay, 40 days and 40 nights. But notice something here. The fountains of the great deep were broken open in 1 day. What most of us believe is, since the Bible is clear, the land was gathered in one place, the continents were one land mass at the beginning. But during the flood process, the fountains of the great deep were opened. What we think happened is a crack came in that continental plate, and that crack ran through the plate. As it ran through the plate, it opened up underneath the water that was underneath. The fountains of the great deep were under great pressure because the weight of the continents laying upon them. As the crack opened up, the water came out under tremendous pressure, probably going up above the atmosphere, being supercooled and falling back to Earth as supercooled ice, because it's probably going to freeze the mammoth in Siberia and Alaska. At the same time, continental plates are going to begin to push apart because of this pressure of this water. As they push apart, huge erosion takes place on the edge of these plates, and that erosion moves over through the water and begins to flood and capture all the animals, forming the fossil record of both the fossil fuels and the fossil animals. As the plates move apart, the mid-oceanic ridge begins to rise in the Atlantic, and the continental plates continue to separate. As the continental plates continue to separate, they move apart. As they move apart, they accumulate the sedimentary rock on top of them, and then they hit resistance. When they hit resistance, it pushes up the mountains and pulls down the ocean trenches. That's the flood. Kind of amazing, isn't it? Amazing process. And that's what we think happened. It goes on to describe it here, the flood itself. It talks about the fact that all the creatures on the land are going to die. They're going to actually be buried, and most of them in the fossil record. Not most of the people, most of the creatures. And it describes, again, the breath of life, those creatures. And it gives us the time frame. So we had the release of the canopy water. Windows of heaven are opened. The canopy collapses. It rains. The water falls out of a clear sky. Still no weather. Okay, the rain begins to collapse. That happens for 40 days. The subterranean water, however, is released, as I just described, through the process of the separation of the plates and the movement of the continental plates. Animals are trapped and buried. The mammoths are frozen. The vegetation, the huge quantity of plants, is washed together, compressed and buried in the ground, and becomes how you came here today. That's what gas and oil is. Vegetable material, buried, compressed, and heated. We can make oil or coal in a laboratory in the time frame of about between 8 hours and 2 days. It doesn't take long periods of time to make coal or oil. Volcanic action on a grand scale. I say volcanic action because volcanoes today are little dinky things. Even Mount St. Helens, which would have been quite impressive for us to watch, is a little dinky thing. And it's a little dinky thing because we find in some places on the earth pieces of lava, single flows, the size of the state of Montana. So there were volcanic action on grand scales here that we have never seen before. And then following the flood is an ice age of monumental proportions. The oceans are warm, the continents are cold. The new weather regime comes into existence. As a result, huge amounts of snow begin to fall on the continents, and ice age comes. And the geological evidence for the ice age is kind of overwhelming. It kind of presses down pretty hard. And the modern events that would be similar to this, of course, Krakatoa is probably the one that's close to giving the Earth a scare. The recent tsunami was significant, but it wasn't as significant as Krakatoa, because when Krakatoa exploded in 1880, you know, the planet shook. The shockwave actually went around the planet 2 times. And so much material was thrown in the upper atmosphere that it caused what was called the year without a summer. It caused a lot of famine as a result of that explosion. That was a small catastrophic event in light of the flood itself. One of the questions I get on my webpage all the time is, well, how can We flood the earth. Is there enough water? Well, if you made the earth smooth like a ping pong ball, there'd be 9,000 feet of water on the surface of the planet. Plenty of water to flood the earth. It's not a problem to flood the earth with water. If you just look at the earth from space, right, 2/3 of the earth is covered with water. And some of that ocean is very deep. I look at Grand Canyon. How many have been to Grand Canyon? Quite a few. How many have been to Tetons? Good. Okay, that's good. That's good because I'm going to use two illustrations here, and it'll some of you have been there. It'll help you understand a little bit. But the Grand Canyon, the question is, how is it formed? A lot of time in a little water, or a lot of water in a little time? The canyon doesn't tell you. So it's a matter of interpretation. And understand, geology itself is a matter of interpretation. Okay, it's a matter of how we see things. Okay, it is a lot of water and a little time. And if you go to my webpage and ask me that question, I'll send you a bunch of stuff about exactly how that works. Let's talk about fossils for a moment, okay? This is how evolutionists would expect us to believe fossils form. A fish dies, it lays on the bottom of the ocean, and it gets covered up slowly with sediment, eventually rots away and gets a buried skeleton. However, that's not what happens when a fish dies. When a fish dies, it either floats to the top and decomposes and gets eaten, or it falls to the bottom and the scavengers tear it apart. Fish don't die and get buried. Fossilization itself requires rapid events. We got this little fishy swimming along here. He's having a really good day. But he doesn't know Noah's flood has started. And suddenly, he gets overwhelmed with a massive mud flow and he gets buried. And there are, ladies and gentlemen, in some places in the world, millions of fish fossilized in an area where their eyes are bulging, their fins are distended. These fish are suddenly panicked because this is what's happened. They've been suddenly overwhelmed by something and buried. Of course, then he dies. Without oxygen, without water, he's dead. His body decomposes, and guess what? He becomes a fossil. Now, that fossil, that's at the moment, that's just buried bones. Because fossils aren't buried bones. You understand that? Fossils are stone pictures of bones. When you dig up a fossil and you find a fossil, it's not the original bone most of the time. Like you find original bone, that's kind of amazing because most fossils aren't. They're mineralized replacements of the bone. The bone disappears and minerals replace it. It's bone in stone and it becomes a stone in stone. There are on the planet billions of dead things buried in rock layers, laid down by water all over the earth. That's what we call the fossil record. And the fossil record encompasses ocean bottom, land bottom, creatures, and some people, but not many. Let me follow the process for a moment. If you look at the fossils over the whole planet, what you'll find is 95% of all the fossils on the planet represent ocean bottom. They're called Cambrian. Of the remaining 5%, 95% of that is land bottom. Insects and plants. So there's 5% of 5% before we get to the animals. Yet there are billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth because there were billions of creatures that were captured. And most of the animals that are fossilized in what's called bone beds, places where the water swept together large numbers of creatures and buried them in a mass grave. There's one in Kansas right near us here. There's one in Alberta, Canada with mostly dinosaurs. There's one in Geiseltal, Germany. But in every case, the creatures are buried in a mass grave. They're not a couple creatures that died here or there. I mean, in the American West, this part of the world actually, in the time before it was populated, the buffalo roamed this whole region. And there were millions of buffalo that were killed by both the Native Americans and later on by the settlers. Do you find any buffalo fossils? No. Not one. Why? Because the buffaloes were killed, their bodies laid on the ground, and the bones decomposed. Fossils require rapid burial. So when you find billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth, it represents a catastrophic event, Noah's flood, that says that if you had the flood, that's what you'd expect to find. You can say it now? Billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth? Why don't you try it with me? Billions of dead things. Oh, you're really weak. Billions of dead things buried in rock layers, laid down by water all over the earth. That's the evidence for Noah's flood, and that's the geology that demonstrates Noah's flood is a real event in Earth history. Let's go on. Fossilization is a process that can take anything from a few hours to millions of years, but in most cases, it takes a relatively short period of time. The amount it takes for a bone to become completely premineralized is highly variable. If the groundwater is heavily laden with minerals in solution, the process can happen rapidly. And in fact, National Geographic, several times in the last couple of years, has talked about the fact that there are fossils on the Earth. They found some in South America just recently, where the fish's eye is actually fossilized. Now, if you know anything about a fish, when a fish dies, one of the first things that decomposes is its eye. So for its eye to become fossilized means you have to fossilize it very quickly, or the eye would disappear long before the fossil could form. So fossilization doesn't take millions of years to happen. Let's look at stalactites and stalagmites. Stalactites and stalagmites are found in caves. They're generally formed from water dripping through a cave containing minerals. And as the water comes through, it deposits as it travels a certain amount of the mineral that it contains in itself, and it comes down and drips from the top to the bottom, okay? The top part becomes a stalactite. Remember that, boys and girls, by the fact that they're on the ceiling and they hold on tight. And this falls to the sea, to the basin, becomes a stalagmite, okay? Now, the question is, how long does it take to form these things? A lot of cave people would have told you this takes thousands or millions of years, okay? However, in recent times, it doesn't appear it takes that long because we have some pretty significant stalactites under the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. You can go by bridges in some parts of the country and find stalactites forming under the bridges. And some cave people know this, okay? There's a fellow in the Forest Service called Jerry Trout, and he says that through photo monitoring, that is, pictures taken once a day, he's seen a stalactite form inches within several days. Stalactite formation has nothing to do with time. It has to do with flow of water. The more water flow you have, the faster or slower the stalactite forms. And you can get them formed very quickly. So the dating of caves, which was done a whole lot in the past, has recognized more and more the fact that it doesn't really take long. And Carlsbad Cavern's a great example, because Carlsbad Cavern's probably the most significant cavern in the North American continent, okay? From 1924 to 1980, the visitors signed at the entrance to Carlsbad Caverns that said Carlsbad was at least 260 million years old. In 1998, the sign was changed to 7 to 10 million years old. Then for a little while, the sign read 2 million years. Now the sign's gone. You see, because evolutionists are not all bad scientists. Some of them are, but not all of them are. And some of them are honest enough to realize that when they get some results, like Mount St. Helens, and that's going to be a very significant problem for them, when they get some results like that, they're going to have to deal with it and make it fit or make their conclusions fit into it. Of course, John Morris says in Young Earth, which is a book on geology, he has a real good way of saying how the evolutionists generally regard science. I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. Okay? I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. Okay, let's talk about the Lost Squadron. When you go to the ice caps in Arctic or Antarctic regions, they do the same thing they do with the deposited sediments in places like Grand Canyon. They count them and cycle one for each year, okay? And ice caps generally form a quarter of an inch to a half an inch in a cycle. So you see the ice caps have got whole lots of what would account to, if you go down in the ice, thousands and thousands of years over only hundreds of feet. I mean, probably 15 or 20,000 years over maybe 100 to 150 feet because the ice caps show all these depositions, okay? Well, it turns out in 1946, there was a series of airplanes that landed on the Greenland ice cap, and they landed and crashed, and they were left, and the pilots were rescued, but the planes were left there. There were two B-17s and six P-38s. Well, in 1988, they went back to try to find these guys, and they said, well, let's find them. They can't be more than, 5 or 10 feet inside the ice, because, ice forms fairly quickly, okay? And back and they began to dig where they were, okay? Well, they didn't find them at all. So they finally went back and they used some radar and sonar devices and finally bounced enough echoes in the ice to find the Lost Squadron. Guess where it was found? 3 miles away and 250 feet down in the ice. Something's wrong with the assumptions about the formation of ice, isn't there? You could get the ice caps in North and in the Antarctic and the Arctic at the depth they are today in less than 4,000 years. You don't need thousands and thousands of years. So again, here's a piece of good science. I mean, this is real. They found these airplanes down there. They actually went back and took one out and rebuilt it to the point of actually putting the airplane in a condition where it could fly. Now, you got to bear in mind that a lot of the parts they reconstructed, okay? But they actually did take one out, actually one of the P-38s they actually put back into service for a while just to demonstrate it could be done. But it was 250 feet down in the ice, way below where it should have been if the ice had formed in the uniform principle. So, but Noah came off the ark. What's the first thing he did? Offered an offering to God. This has been a traumatic experience. He left the world that was beautiful. He left the world that originally, before sin came, was a perfect world. It wasn't anymore. But it was certainly beautiful. I mean, things were huge. Things were lush. The animals were basically civil to one another. They weren't killing one another. They may have, but there's no reason to. And the animals came off, and Noah sacrificed because now what do you see? A barren wasteland. The earth had been devastated. The whole planet had been wiped clean. Mankind had been wiped out. The plants, although it was beginning to come back, were not many yet at all. If we look at the mountain ranges of the world, and we'll take all of them, right? The Andes, the Alps, the Himalayas, the Rockies, even the Appalachians, where I live in North Carolina. And you go to the tops of the mountain ranges. What do you find? You find fossils of creatures from the bottom of the sea. Noah's flood is demonstrated by the mountains themselves. You find fish fossils all over the cuts in the Rockies. I mean, where I live in North Carolina, you go to any road cut that's got what we call the white rock, okay, which is generally three or four different kinds of rock, and you begin to pick through it and knock it off the side of the wall, you'll begin to find seashells. Seashells at 6, 8, 10, 12,000 feet. That's amazing. But you see, that's because when the flood came, it buried the ocean bottom and raised that up to the top of the mountains as the plates were buckled, as the plates began to settle. Let me go back to the Grand Tetons for a moment. Some of you said you were there. Let me describe them. If you've seen any John Wayne movies with the gray mountains in the background, you've seen the Grand Tetons, okay? That's what they look like. And I was out there with my son. Now, my son's not a believer, okay? And we were out the Grand Tetons, and the ranger came out, and she was telling us how these mountains were formed. And she said, now, listen carefully. Over the last 25 million years, these mountains have been pushed up to this present position. So she went through this long presentation basically saying that. And I was processing the material. And I raised my hand and my son left the room. In fact, he says, Dad, he says, your pictures will be posted so the rangers don't let you ask questions. Because I raised my hand, then she said, yes, sir, because it's question time. She said, yes, sir. I said, I got a question. And I wasn't going to be aggressive or nasty. I was just going to question her, because I know if you use good science, you can always get through the evolutionary garbage. It's not hard to do. You just got to use your brain. I said, how much erosion takes place on those mountains over 25 million years? And she kind of straightened up and said, she knew the answer to this question. This is easy, okay? She said, we believe about 1 foot per 1,000 years is eroded. So I kind of smiled and said, that means 25 million years. 25,000 feet of mountain has disappeared. Where's the stuff? I mean, the ground should have 25,000 feet of layer on the bottom, right? Where the mountain eroded down. She turned a little pale and did the only thing she could do. Went to the ladies' room. She knew she couldn't answer the question because the question's not answered because those mountains are not 25 million years old. There's no way they could be. Okay, I'm going to close with this passage from Peter, and this will kind of set us up for the next session and also help us just put the flood in perspective. Peter says, knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking after their own lusts and saying, where's the promise of his coming? Doubting Christ's coming. For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. That's a great statement of the evolutionary principle called uniformitarianism. For this they are willingly ignorant of, that by the word of God, the heavens of old and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was being overflowed with water perished. But the heavens and earth which are now, by the same word are kept in store. Let me just make a comment on that, okay? And we'll cover this in the next period in some depth. But the universe itself is held together. The very atoms are held together by something. We call them nuclear forces. You know what God? You know what the Bible calls them? In Colossians, it says the power of Christ. By everything is held together by the power of Christ. Okay, so it's held together for reserved to fire in the last days. God is going to take and release it to fire rather than water. And then he goes on to make the 1,000-day statement, and we'll cover that again in the next session. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some men count slackness, but is long-suffering to usward, and not willing that anyone should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heaven shall pass away with a great noise, the elements shall melt with fervent heat, and the earth and the works therein shall be burned up. That's the return to the day one condition, and we'll cover that. Seeing that in these things all be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be, looking for and hasting in the coming of the day of the Lord, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, according to his promise, we look for a new heaven and a new earth wherein dwells righteousness. I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. Let me just make a couple points here. Two kinds of prophecy, telling God's will and telling the future. Prophecy must be consistent with God's word, with revelation. It must lead to follow God, and it must not portray false prophets. You have a false prophet today in the world, Jehovah's Witnesses, because they come and say, they speak in God's name, and they say things are going to happen that don't happen. That's a false prophet. If we did what the Bible said, we'd stone them. We don't stone them, but that's what the Bible would say to do to them. There were two examples here, Tyre and Nineveh. If you want to read about them, get Josh McDowell's book, which is called Evidence That Demands a Verdict, and read that book, and it deals with these prophecies. Just a couple things about resources. Most of these aren't here, but just resources that are available to cover the issue of Noah's flood. If you want to go further, Genesis Flood by Morrison Whitcomb, that's the book that started the modern creationist movement. After the Flood, which deals with the migration of peoples after the flood. If you want to study some genealogy biblically, that's a good place to go. True Story of Noah's Ark, that's a great picture book. Grand Canyon, that book has evoked huge controversy in the Grand Canyon bookstores because it's a creationist book and it was put there to be sold and the evolutionists have just objected like crazy. It's created a huge issue with that. It remains, however, in the bookstore, but they put it in the religious section. I mean, it's a book on rocks and fossils. How can you put it in the religious section? But that's where they put it because it's a creationist viewpoint. Videos, Mount St. Helens and the Grand Canyon, we've talked about both of those today. Ark, feasibility study, a great place to go if you want to explore Noah's Ark. Creation Geology, a study guide for studying geology, young earth, and then finally some videos that I have that relate to this also. There are two, the workshop content and 10 questions.